I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. My guest today is Vardit Ravitsky, a bioethicist, researcher, and author. She is a professor at the University of Montreal and a part-time senior lecturer on global health and social medicine at Harvard Medical School. She is the director of ethics and health at the Center for Research on Ethics, the president of the International Association of Bioethics, and a fellow of the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation, where she chairs the COVID-19 Impact Committee. She is also fellow of the Hastings Center and of the Canadian Academy of Health Sciences. Born and raised in Jerusalem, Ravitsky brings international perspectives to her research and teaching with a BA in philosophy from the Sorbonne University in Paris, an MA in philosophy from the University of New Mexico, and a PhD in philosophy from Bar-Ilan University in Israel. She was a postdoctoral fellow at the Department of Bioethics of the NIH and at the National Human Genome Research Institute. The conversation today will focus on the challenging ethical issues arising from a new biotechnology called non-invasive prenatal testing. Vardit Ravitsky, welcome to Delving In.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by letting our audience know what we're talking about when we refer to non-invasive prenatal screening, or NIPT. It would be helpful, if you don't mind, to talk about your own light bulb flash moment when you first learned of NIPT during your own pregnancy. I think it would really bring it home to hear that story.
Yeah, so I was 40 and pregnant, and like most women in Canada, and actually most women in Western countries, I was offered prenatal screening, which involves a couple of blood tests, ultrasound. The result of all this is a number, a percentage, a risk result. And I was told at the time that my result is positive, which means high risk, which meant in Canada at the time, a chance of 1 in 200 that the fetus that I was carrying had trisomy 21, also known as Down syndrome. So what that means for women is that then they then face a decision regarding what to do with this information, because it's not certain, right? It's just a chance. And if you are very eager to know with certainty the status, the genetic status of the fetus you're carrying, your only option is to continue on to an invasive test, which is diagnostic, which means gives you certain information. And this test is very familiar, amniocentesis, in which a long needle is inserted through the abdomen into the uterus in order to collect some amniotic fluid. And fetal DNA can be found in that fluid, and then you get a diagnostic result. Your fetus has or does not have 100% certainty Down syndrome, and then you can make decisions based on that. Our difficulty was that I was 40. It was an extremely desired, precious pregnancy. And there is a risk of miscarriage associated with this insertion of the needle into your uterus, which was designed to remain hermetically closed. So when anything enters this very protected environment, there's risk of infection and a risk of losing this very desired pregnancy. So we faced that excruciating decision. On one hand, we wanted to know with certainty. We felt anxious. On the other hand, there was a price tag to this knowledge. We had to take a risk on our very precious pregnancy if we wanted better information.
And the reason to have the information, if I'm not mistaken, is one of two things. One is if there's a willingness, at least possibly, to abort if there is a serious abnormality. And the other is to not be interested or willing to abort, but wanting to have the preparation, wanting to know in advance to be able to adjust to the reality of it before the birth.
Precisely. And I'm really delighted that you framed it in this way, because so much of the clinical conversation around prenatal testing, whether it's screening or diagnosis, centers on this option of terminating the pregnancy. Women don't hear enough that this is not about necessarily or even possibly terminating the pregnancy. It's about information. and information can be used in many ways. It can be used to prepare psychologically for the arrival of a child with special needs. It can be used practically to collect information regarding a child with medical needs. It can be used to connect with other families raising a child who has the same condition as the child you're expecting, garner some more family and community support. One of the options is termination, but the discourse in many Western countries has really centered on using this information in a binary way, continue or stop the pregnancy. And that led to this terrible expression that we find in the literature that prenatal testing is a search and destroy mission. Sometimes women feel that the way clinicians present these tests to them is as if they're there to search for the, we use the neutral term affected, but the flawed or the abnormal fetus in order to destroy it, allowing only what, perfect fetuses to be born. So as you can see from my tone and my sarcasm, I'm very critical of this discourse. To me, this testing is about information. For myself and my husband at the time, it was not clear at all what we wanted to do with this information. I'm not even sure we considered termination as a serious option, but we still very anxiously wanted to know.
Right. And a part of your experience of learning about NIPT and that situation, if I remember right, it was a real moment of amazement for you that such information was possible.
Exactly. So at the time that my husband and I were struggling with this decision regarding amniocentesis, taking the risk or not, I was trying to find other ways to obtain better information. So I went for another ultrasound. So they measured the parts of the fetus yet again. And I went for another session of genetic counseling. And you have to remember that I was working in this area. I had access to the best brains and the best expertise. I went on a call with the head of the genetic counseling program at the NIH to get her advice because she was a friend and a colleague. Not all women have access to this expertise that I could tap into. And yet, there was no way of getting better information. I met expert after expert, and the only answer they had for me was either chance or invasive testing. There is no other test or technology that we can offer you. We decided not to do the amniocentesis. The rest of the pregnancy was filled with a certain level of anxiety. My daughter was born, but I remained with this lingering general anxiety, not for myself, but for all women in all pregnancy, about how come we've had prenatal testing for decades and women still face this terrible dilemma, either risk or uncertainty. And then when I actually read that paper that you're referring to, the first time I read about non-invasive prenatal testing, it literally blew my brain because there was the technology that gives the information that I was after when I was pregnant. It didn't exist then. It wasn't available then. The story is this. For many years, researchers were looking for fetal cells in the pregnant woman's blood. And the thinking was, if we can identify fetal material in the bloodstream, all it would take is a blood test. Pregnant women go through millions of blood tests throughout their pregnancy. It would be just another one. And it would replace that needle or other invasive tests that can be done, such as CVS. But all the invasive tests, all the diagnostic tests are invasive. This would be a test that is much more reliable without invasion. But for years, these fetal cells in the woman's blood could not be found, could not be identified. And a discovery in 1997 led to NIPT. That was the discovery that in our bloodstream, yours, mine, all the listeners, other than cells, there are also tiny microscopic fragments of DNA from broken cells. We call that cell-free DNA. So cells that have died or broken up release these tiny fragments, just a few base pairs long, into our blood. And when a woman becomes pregnant after 9 or 10 weeks, still first trimester of early on, about 10% of those fragments come from the placenta. The placenta releases them into the bloodstream. They're detectable, and they actually are identical to the fetus. So that was, I still think this will win a Nobel Prize in the coming years. I totally put my money on that. I met the researcher who discovered it, Dennis Ho, in his big lab in Hong Kong. It's one of the most important discoveries of the 21st century, because other than allowing us to find the fetal DNA in women's blood, it's now also used to better diagnose cancer tumors and other diagnostic measures. So this is just one of the biggest medical breakthroughs in general. But for prenatal testing, this was the holy grail. This was the way to find the fetus in the blood and get women much better information without risk of miscarriage.
Okay, so before we get to the ethical implications of that information and how to deliver it and whether to deliver it, let's talk a little bit more about what information the non-invasive prenatal testing gives now and what the hope is for the future.
So if you're asking yourself, is my fetus male or female? That you can know with 100% certainty, because think about it logically. If I'm a woman and Y pieces of Y chromosome are found in my blood, they probably don't come from me, and the fetus is male. So this technology is at 100% certainty for sex, for fetal sex determination. Also blood type, that's another story. But when it comes to trisomy 21 Down syndrome, the level of accuracy is over 99%. So we're talking about 99.7 in most cases. That's still not diagnostic. It still means that we could have false positives and false negatives, but it's almost there. For some clinicians, some call it quasi-diagnostic. And what it means is, for a woman like myself, if I did NIPT at the time, I'd get a negative result. I'd be told 99.8% that your fetus does not have Down syndrome, and I would feel no need to even consider invasive testing. I'd feel like I know enough, and I'd live the rest of my pregnancy with some peace of mind, or a lot of peace of mind. If there is a positive result from NIPT, i.e. the fetus does seem to have trisomy, invasive testing is still highly recommended because, again, there's this shred of a doubt, and clinicians don't want termination decisions to be made when there's a chance that it's not the real result. But actually, some women are voting with their feet and actually terminating pregnancies based on NIPT without the confirmation of invasive testing, which I find a great shame, because that could lead to tragedy. NIPT today can also detect with good reliability, not 99%, but in the high 80%, trisomy 18 and 13, which are fatal. These are babies that almost always die shortly after birth. Down syndrome is a condition that leads to a long and happy life with some limitations, but there's no comparison between the great quality of life with Down syndrome and those two other trisomies that are fatal and very tragic. And then now, NIPT can also detect a lot of diseases that one single mutation is responsible for. Abnormalities in the sex chromosomes, some syndromes in which the sex chromosomes are not exactly one of each. Technically, this technology can today already sequence the entire genome of the fetus, which again blows my mind, because just imagine getting the full genome of your fetus at 11 or 10 weeks of pregnancy. Any risk that 23andMe can tell you, any unexpected result about a disease that you didn't even know your family was carrying, all of that can be available to you in the first trimester of pregnancy. that's a new world. That's a complete revolution in prenatal testing.
You know, I don't know if this is a good analogy, but it strikes me the technology is so amazing. It's as if you had a shredded book and you're putting the book back together, you know, in terms of finding these pieces of DNA in the blood. So it's really quite amazing.
Absolutely. I love your analogy, and what it's making me realize is it's a very scary book. Because imagine you're putting together a book that tells you some things you didn't want to know, but now are you exposed to. It tells you different pieces of information about your future life at different degrees of reliability. It's like a crystal ball that tells you this child might have breast cancer. Maybe at the age of 60, this child might have Alzheimer's in its 80s, and it might have a childhood disease, but the risk for each of these is at a different percentage level. And then it tells you that your child will definitely have certain things that you've never heard of and you're not sure if you care about, and you're under time pressure to make decisions. It's excruciating.
And 100% a chance of eventual mortality. By some cause.
Precisely. As we all know, life is a sexually transmitted disease with 100% mortality.
There you go. So let's shift now to talking about the ethical implications, which are really fascinating. I mean, the technology on the biological level is fascinating, and I think the ethics is also incredibly fascinating. Just a very quick summary of the questions is this technology good for women, for their partners, for the subsequent children, for societal concerns about strains in society, for societal attitudes toward disabilities? I mean, there's so many different areas of ethical interest here. And I think of general ethical interest. It's not just for the experts. I mean, this affects almost everybody, it seems to me, anyone who's been born into this world. So let's see if we can maybe tease this apart and talk about each of these concerns. The first one, it's maybe the most obvious one, is the dilemma between personal autonomy. Maybe dilemma is not the right word, but the tension between personal autonomy and societal concern. So personal autonomy of the pregnant woman and her partner, and the societal concern to limit the number of children with really serious disabilities. And how does that play out, and how do they compete with each other, and how do you navigate that?
Before I answer that, I just wanted to clarify that whole genome sequencing using NIPT is not clinically available yet. I don't want listeners to get the impression that this is just a product you go and buy, but it's technically possible, and things that are technically possible end up becoming products because the market is there. But it's not like it's available now. Yeah. So one of the problems with NIPT, it's huge success. It's probably the fastest emerging or spreading genomics technology worldwide. It's only available since 2011. So, you know, it's celebrating its 10th birthday now. It's already available in 60 countries. In 2018 alone, millions of tests were performed. So this is a technology that not only has a huge market of billions, but also women are really interested in it. Surveys that were conducted country after country show that women want this. And if you go back to my story, it's clear why. If you're getting a very iffy high chance result, you want better information, and this is easily available to you, just another blood test. So women who were surveyed or interviewed regarding how they see this technology had very positive views. Women want this. Their partners as well, their clinicians as well. So on the individual level, I think anything that allows you better access to better information increases your autonomy. You know, we live in a culture where knowledge is power. Studies that ask parents, do you want lots of genetic information about your fetus or a little? Parents always say a lot. We're used to wanting more information, thinking that this allows us better decisions. So not always the case. But in terms of the autonomy of individual women, their partners, their families, I think this is a great thing. as long as you're making an informed and free decision about using it. And what we're seeing is, once the technology is out there and there's no risk of miscarriage, and especially in countries where it's already publicly funded, so it's available to you free of charge, women might feel that they're not just offered this technology, but encouraged, maybe even pushed to use it. What does it take to say no to prenatal testing? Let's flip it over. If I'm offered a test that carries no risk to my pregnancy, and if my government's paying for it, what is the message that I'm getting? That I should do it. That if I don't do it, I'm what? I'm an irresponsible mother before I even gave birth because I'm not interested in medical information about my fetus. But what we're forgetting is that my fetus cannot be treated or cured based on this information. It can either be born like that or be terminated. So you're beginning to see how navigating this decision in a way is even more complicated when the test is risk-free and doesn't even cost me. Because then it's almost like I have no excuse to reject it. I feel obligated to know. And then I'm faced with the knowledge and I'm forced to make a decision.
Yes, so it's maybe analogous to the situations with Facebook and other big companies where in order to not give permission, you have to opt out. It's kind of the assumption is you're going to opt in unless you say otherwise, and it's that's non-informed consent, and yet it may seem like it.
So all those situations in which we give our consent, but if we say no, we pay a very high social price. Our consent can still be informed. You know, if you want to read the, if you want to scroll down on Facebook or any other site and read all the tiny letters of their legal documentation and then sign, you're informed. But did you give free consent? And the free can mean many things. Nobody points a gun to your head telling you to be on Facebook. But if you lose the real life possibility to stay in touch with friends and family because everybody else is there, you lost some degree of freedom regarding participating or not. And the fear about NIPT, I think, is that it will become so routinized, so much a part of the sort of obvious pathway of pregnancy follow-up, of pregnancy care, that women will feel like to opt out has a price tag because they'll feel judged by their healthcare provider or even by their own families.
And there are two reasons to, it seems to me, to opt out. One would be that you're very clearly never going to be willing to have an abortion, and therefore you don't want the information in advance because you don't want the anxiety of let's say, knowing that there's a problem until it comes. You know, that you'd rather not have the anxiety during the pregnancy. You will deal with anxiety after the pregnancy. Similar to even if you're clear that you might abort, I mean that then you probably always want to know. I mean, wouldn't that be pretty much the breakdown that you have to have at least some willingness to abort to want the information, and then if you're not willing to abort, then there's maybe a small percentage of women that don't want the information. I mean, how did the surveys come out?
So again, I resist this breakdown along the lines of considering termination or not. Because, for example, for me, I was extremely eager to know, but it wasn't about termination. It was about preparation. It wasn't about preparing myself, my extended family. I come from a cultural context that does not accept easily a birth of a child with a problem that could have been detected. I felt like I needed to prepare the tribe, not just ourselves. So I insist on this because there are other reasons to want testing other than termination. When we flip it over, as we just did, and ask why would women not want, one reason could be that they're not considering termination and therefore think the information is irrelevant. Other reasons, exactly as you said, is they're not considering termination and they don't want to know because they have a different personality than me. I always need to know in advance and prepare for everything in life. And other people prefer the surprise or dealing with situations as they emerge. Other women just don't want any aspect of medicalization of their pregnancy. They have this vision of a natural pregnancy and they want to minimize the medical interventions. So there are many reasons to reject prenatal testing, and women do reject it. My point is that the more it's routine, the more it's publicly funded, the more, in a way, it increases your access, which is a good thing for your autonomy. At the same time, the other side of that same coin is that it increases the pressure on you to opt in or to stay in.
And are there some countries that maybe even have a policy that we don't want as a country to have fetuses or come to term with an abnormality, that it's too much of a burden on society, that sort of thing? I don't know. I'm sort of imagining maybe China. I don't know. Are there countries where it's much more routine and not only accepted by the public, but actually pushed by the government to terminate such pregnancies?
So here again, we need to distinguish. I'm insisting on this because I think it's really important culturally to keep these things distinct. There can be a government push to test in order to know. And then there can be, at another level, a government push to terminate, which is obviously much more socially dangerous and for us would be basically a human rights violation. The right of the woman to bodily integrity and the right to autonomous choice in all matters related to reproduction. So a system that pushes women to test, I think, exists in most Western countries today because this is considered normal medical follow-up, because many elements of this testing are already funded. So it's not maybe explicit pushing, but implicitly, I think we're already in a reality where women are pushed to test. Obviously, in Western countries, they're never pushed to terminate. There's a clear line in the sand where this is absolutely your decision. Quite on the contrary, some U.S. states are trying to push legislation to ban abortion based on a diagnosis of Down syndrome. So specifically, if you tested and got a result, then it becomes illegal to terminate your pregnancy. Very curious as an approach. But you are right that China is the only country that has an explicit, non-apologetic, eugenic policy. They recently launched a new sort of public health campaign with the objective of reducing abnormalities at birth. They speak the language of using genetic testing in pregnancy to ensure the birth of productive citizens. You know, we don't use this language in the West. We're completely traumatized by Nazi ideology and the notion that people with disabilities or people with diseases are a burden of society. We would never voice such positions without being heavily criticized as eugenicists. In China, and as I said, non-apologetic. It's about reducing the burden on society.
Yeah, and those eugenic attitudes were not just in Germany. They were very prominent in the United States at that time, too. So I think that the Western world was, I think, traumatized by those. And when you know, with the word eugenics, it's obviously a slippery slope from trying to limit the number of abnormalities to then saying, well, let's select for superiorities in the genome. And then it becomes a really scary kind of scenario. We'll only select for characteristics.
You know, to me, it doesn't even require that slippery slope to become super scary. Because even if we're not going in the direction of enhancement and superiority and perfect babies, even if we just stay at the stage of eliminating babies with, I don't know what to call it, what society perceives as problems, babies with special medical needs, exactly, special medical needs or special societal needs, babies with disabilities. That's already, to me, extremely disturbing for the following reason. To me, pregnancy, reproduction is a personal matter, and these decisions should remain at the individual level. Some families feel very well equipped to raise a child with Down syndrome. a deaf child. Some families prefer a deaf child because the parents are deaf and they're a part of deaf culture and deaf community, and that's their preference. Some families feel like they don't have the emotional or the financial resources to cope with any type of special need. It's a personal decision. It depends on your own values, your own resources, your cultural background. I think the ethical thing is, as a society, to ensure that these decisions are free. And by free, I mean free of societal pressures, so that the decision can actually align with your own set of values. As soon as we have a social agenda, whether it's to eliminate this kind of baby or the other, we're already in a eugenic world. We need to not only encourage women to make their own decisions, we have to create a society where they know in advance that their child will be welcome and supported. When we talked to women about the decisions surrounding prenatal testing, specifically regarding Down syndrome, some of them said, look, I personally have no problem raising a child with Down syndrome. My friend is raising such a child, lovely child, goes to school, happy family, wonderful quality of life. It's not a threat to me. But I live in a society that provides almost no services. I live in a society where I understand that the burden will fall on us, the extra burden. Every child is a burden. The extra burden will fall on us. And with the absence of a social support, I feel that I'm not equipped to do this. That's the unethical world I want to avoid.
And I know it's a concern among disability rights groups, including for Down syndrome, that if such children are, if the birth of them are reduced because of prenatal testing, so for instance, the number of children born with Down syndrome has been declining because I think most of them are in fact terminated. And so if the number falls below a certain percentage of the population, maybe the services will start to disappear and the level of acceptance, because of lack of contact, people won't see them as much. Has that actually happened? I mean, I'm pretty sure that the numbers are going down because of prenatal testing. And has there been an increase of stigma as the number of Down syndrome children is declining? Are there different societal attitudes or no? So I haven't witnessed any myself personally.
You're asking a fascinating question because it's actually very complex. Most women receiving a diagnostic result that their fetus has Down syndrome choose to terminate their pregnancies. That is true. What percentage? That varies between countries. You can go from 90% to 60%. But the majority of these pregnancies are being terminated. That's a fact. In Nature, trisomy 21 occurs in 1 in 800 pregnancies. It's the most prevalent genetic condition in the human population. So is prenatal testing reducing the natural birth rate of babies with trisomy 21? Yes, it does. To a point that most people have never met a child with Down syndrome, potentially. I don't know the answer to that. But what that reality does, and I'm not talking about countries such as Iceland where, you know, it was all over the media that they have maybe one birth of Down syndrome a year, they're sort of on a path to eradicate it from the population. You don't eradicate a genetic condition that occurs spontaneously, right? It's not a heritable disease where, like, you know, Tay-Sachs is an inheritable genetic disease that the Ashkenazi Jewish community almost eradicated in two generations with genetic testing. Down syndrome occurs spontaneously at conception. It's not something you eradicate. It's always going to occur. But that aside, I think the answer to your question, bottom line, is complex. On one hand, when we're not used to seeing people in society with certain conditions, the stigma does increase. In Ireland, abortion was illegal until very recently. And walking down the street, you would always see somebody with Down syndrome. You'd see groups of teenagers with Down syndrome going out to have fun. It would be everywhere. every extended, you know, Irish big families, every extended family had a member with Down syndrome. And it was just not a big deal. Social integration was seamless and just not a big deal. As the numbers reduce and you've never actually met anyone, I've met genetic counselors who've never met an individual with Down syndrome who counsel families about this decision. Like, what's wrong with that picture? And so I think you're right. The stigma can increase when a condition becomes so rare that it becomes this black box and we don't actually know what it means to raise a child with that condition. And that's not just for Down syndrome, it's for many other conditions. It becomes just a label. It becomes a scary concept rather than something that we can relate to. So at the level of stigma, I think you're right. Another aspect of stigma is what I'm hearing from women who had a child with a certain condition, and then there's some medical issue. They show up at the hospital and a nurse or a doctor would say to them, "You didn't test?" And what is implicit in that question? Like, why are you even here with your child if genetic tested could have taken care of it through termination? Like, what message does the medical establishment send parents regarding children who are already here that should have been, you know, search and destroy, as I said, before birth? So the stigma is embedded in our medical system as well. Every condition that could have been detected becomes a question of, hey, why are you even here? We have to fight against these tendencies with everything we've got. So yeah, stigma is a huge issue. And with stigma comes discrimination, of course. The other side of the coin is, and I heard that from friends who raise children with Down syndrome, a smaller population of children with special needs means more resources. It's almost as if the cake has to be divided into, you know, it can be divided into bigger pieces. So on one hand, you can say when the population decreases, we will dedicate as a society less resources and families will have less support. The other side is, well, maybe it will allow those who are born to get more support. What does it mean for a regular school when it needs to integrate 20 children with Down syndrome versus one child? So in my kid's school, there's a lineup to volunteer to help the boy with Down syndrome. He's nice. Everybody loves him. Everybody wants to hang out with him. There's just one and everybody wants the honor and the privilege of spending the day with him. So I'm using it, of course, just as a metaphor for what I said about resources. The fear is indeed that society will stop recognizing the need and the moral responsibility of supporting families raising children with special needs. But that's a policy decision. That's our decision and we can make the right decision.
Right. There's a danger of it becoming such a rare anomaly that it's off the map. It's entirely. I'd like to return now to talking about the dilemmas about information and how much information to give to a pregnant woman based on the NIPT, the non-invasive prenatal testing. Just to give two analogies that are not the greatest analogies, but I'm very aware that doctors often try to gauge how much information a patient wants. So for instance, in cancer treatment, some patients want to know all about their cancer, all about the odds, and other people say, no, you just make the decision because I don't want the anxiety of having to research this or learn more about it. That would be one example. Another example is in the dispensing of medication, not the dispensing, but the prescribing of medication. There's a long list of possible side effects somebody may have. And the laws about informed consent is the patient's supposed to be warned, especially about serious things. But if you tell every single thing, there's something called the nocebo effect, where a patient may actually start to experience some of these side effects just because they're told about them. And so the doctor has to decide, you know, how much to tell that might be frightening and how much to not tell. And it seems to me that this situation with pregnancy is really ripe for anxiety. I mean, obviously. So how much does the doctor want to tell? How much does the patient want to hear? Is there a way the patient can let the doctor know, okay, I want to have, you know, 80% of the information. Obviously, it's not going to be a percentage, but I want to have so much of the information, but not, you know, I want to leave some of that up to you. I mean, it seems very tricky. And it seems to me that doctors are between a rock and a hard place. They don't want to overly alarm their patient, but they also want to protect themselves from potential lawsuits that could come their way if they don't inform the patient.
Pregnancy is indeed, as you said, a very unique situation because you're under time pressure. The clock is ticking. The fetus is growing. Legally, you can cross the line in the United States where abortion would become impossible from a legal perspective. And any decision you make is irreversible, right? If you terminate, you can't have it back. If you have the baby's born, you carry the responsibility for the care of the child for the rest of your life. The stakes are enormous. The decision is irreversible and the clock is ticking. So you really have this pressure cooker surrounding your decision. Now, the way NIPT works is that doctors prescribe the test, but you get the result from the company and then you look at it with your doctor. So you actually control what information will be detected when it's prescribed. In some countries, it's not your decision. The government decided what conditions will be communicated, either just those three trisomies that I described, maybe sex chromosome abnormalities. That's about where it stops today. If you go directly to purchase it out of pocket, companies sell products. And these products are kind of packages of conditions. And the more you pay, the more information you get. So currently, women have full control over deciding what they will get because they, beyond a sort of a basic package, they purchase the rest. So it's not like your doctor is sitting all this on this mountain of information thinking, what am I going to tell her? No, you're the one who decided what to buy. And I use this economic language because all these extra tests that I talked about are not publicly funded yet. So that kind of ensures in a way that you as the customer knows exactly what you're buying. But this will change, right? Because I think that the public funding will expand over time and governments will offer more and more information. And then the questions that you asked all arise. And a lot of it is a matter of personality. Some of us want to know more, some less. Where I'm particularly concerned is with this risk information, because there are two types of genetic information. And that's what we call level of penetrance. For some things, if you have the gene, you will be sick. Tay-Sachs, Huntington's disease. For other things, if you have the gene, you have an increased risk to become sick, which means increased in relation to normal the rest of the population. So that's, for example, the breast cancer gene or the Alzheimer's gene. Telling pregnant women your fetus has the gene that will definitely cause disease is already complex because some of these diseases come later in life. So that's already an excruciating decision, thinking process. But what if we start flooding them with risk information? For each condition, it's a different percentage and a different year of onset. Like it seriously becomes like a crystal ball into your child's life. And all of us have something.
As well as a Pandora's box.
Absolutely. So I think you're right. There's tons of anxiety associated. Decision-making could become close to impossible. Weighing apples and oranges, different levels of risk, different types of conditions. We actually wrote a paper arguing that unrestricted access to information does not translate to enhanced autonomy. Because beyond a certain level of information, you're not making decisions anymore. You're rolling dices and you're just one big ball of anxiety trying to think through so many little dimensions and layers that your pregnancy has become close to a nightmare.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what percentage of the population can even has the skill set to understand probability, you know, and what that means and what relative probabilities are. I mean, it's just that you hear about a condition and it could happen. That's all you hear. And then your mind starts to go into a PTSD fog or pre-TSD. How about that? I've heard that with the risk to doctors, there's even a risk of a wrongful life suit. I don't know if this has actually happened or if this is just hypothetical, that's a woman who wasn't apprised of her option for NIPT, wound up having a child with a very severe disability and very costly, and sue the doctor for not letting them know because they would have terminated the pregnancy, or so they say. And I don't know if this has actually happened or if this is just a hypothetical.
It hasn't happened with NIPT specifically, with this novel technology. It's only been around for 10 years. There is no precedent regarding NIPT specifically, but it has happened with other methods of prenatal testing that have been around for decades. It's a very dicey issue. On one hand, our team in Canada ran a legal analysis to see if it's possible that physicians have a legal obligation to offer NIPT to patients. And the reason it's complex is that NIPT's reliability evolved over time. In the early years, shortly after it became a commercially available test in 2011, when we surveyed clinicians, they were not offering, many of them were not offering it because they just didn't understand the technology. And they were not educated or trained to explain to their patients what this test is, what is its reliability, what sort of results it can give you. It was just too new. And it was so fascinating to see physicians admitting to us in surveys that they don't offer it because they don't know how to talk about it. And so there was a glaring need for quick training. Then the test improved. It became more familiar. I think today most offer it. But when do you pass the point that a test is standardized enough or well-established enough that as a doctor, it becomes your not choice, but obligation to offer it to your patients? That's not a clear point in time. It evolves. So our analysis actually says that at this point in time, definitely a doctor that does not offer NIPT. Let's go back to my example. If my doctor never told me about this and I went and did amniocentesis and had a miscarriage, I could probably sue my doctor for the loss of that pregnancy, saying there was another test available to me. You did not tell me about it, and that resulted in the loss of my fetus, and I see you as liable for that. That lawsuit could work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a couple of areas that we haven't touched on, I think that we have just enough time to talk about. And one of them is if NIPT starts to be given routinely, the question is, well, who's going to do the genetic counseling that would need to go along with it in order to have robust informed consent? I mean, it would be an enormous amount of counseling hours. And as we know, doctors usually don't have the time to do that. Would there be a whole new, I mean, there is a profession of genetic counselor, but would there be suddenly have to be a huge increase of that? Or would there be videos produced by the Institutes of Public Health in each country that would try to inform the pregnant woman and her partner about what the cost benefits are? I mean, it seems like that's a very difficult aspect, and it's the need for counseling and the arrangement for reimbursement of that has not kept up yet. In the 10 years that NIPT has been around, it seems that it's kind of a recipe for disaster in the sense that there's a pressure for doctors to offer it, and yet there's also pressure not to talk about it too much because they don't get reimbursed.
You're putting your finger on one of the biggest problems. We actually published a paper, came out yesterday, in which we surveyed several countries around the world to see how NIPT is being implemented. And we found that in each and every country, there's a shortage of trained healthcare providers to counsel women regarding NIPT. Whether it's OB-GYNs, family doctors, trained genetic counselors, there's not enough of them as there's not enough time to discuss. The traditional model is at least 1 hour of face-to-face with a trained genetic counselor, but that was given to women before amniocentesis, before they actually made a decision that involved a risk. It was never offered for screening that was non-invasive and risk-free to the fetus. So the healthcare system is not built to offer that traditional full hour with a highly trained professional before every screening test. Never did. So what happens with NIPT becomes almost diagnostic for so many conditions. Women will consent without really understanding what they're consenting to, and we will only counsel those who get positive results for something, maybe, but then it's not really informed consent, as you said. The solution, anybody doing research in this area, like myself, realizes the solution is sort of a next generation counseling models. It cannot rely anymore on healthcare professionals' time or face-to-face, one-on-one type of conversation. So we're all working hard to prepare those electronic materials or written materials that you talked about. We're developing decision aid tools. That's a structured process that guides the conversation with your physician so that it can be fast, effective, and consider not just the medical information, but also your values, leading to a good decision. We're developing a website. We're developing interactive electronic tools in which you can sort of insert your questions and get information at different levels according to your desire to exposure to information, right? So first of all, you get very high-level information, then you can click on read more, read more, read more, and you stop when you've had enough. A lot of work is being done in this space to create informational materials because currently they're mostly produced by the companies and the company's trying to sell you something. So these materials are suspect for being biased because they have their own agenda.
So where can pregnant women go now? I mean, this is under development. What you're talking about, is there information already available that's valid and non-biased?
Yeah. So first of all, specifically regarding conditions that NIPT can diagnose, the gold standard resource is lettercase.org, spelled simply lettercase, one word, .org, which has online, and you can also get by mail booklets explaining giving fantastic, balanced, comprehensive information about the testing process and about how to think post-diagnosis about your options. There are quite a few websites that are not company generated that you can go to. And we're working within a Pegasus study that is a Canadian government funded study, and our website is almost ready. That's where we have these videos and interactive tools. But everywhere I lecture, people tell me, come on, finish the work. We need this. So it's nice to think that once it's ready, there will be good uptake of it.
Okay, last question, and this is probably only enough time to do it while standing on one foot, so to speak. What are some of the differences between the Canadian and American models for this? I mean, is it very different? I mean, you've been talking as currently a Canadian, but of course, Canada being close to the United States, I'm sure you're very involved in the American thinking about this too. What would you say are some of the differences?
One difference is about the funding of NIPT. Canadian women expect things to be funded. So there's a lot of pressure on the provincial Canadian governments to include NIPT in pregnancy services that are covered. A few provinces, one territory already made that decision and covered NIPT, but only for a certain group of pregnant women. Others are struggling with this decision. In the U.S., the approach is more insurance-based, of course. So it's a patchwork of insurance schemes. Some cover, some don't. I think in Canada, eventually, in a few years, it will just be covered everywhere for everybody. I think that's what we're going towards. Whereas in the U.S., it will, as always, depend on your coverage, and that will create a gap. So the women with less resources will have to pay for it out of pocket, which is absurd.
Right. So as usual, we have a much more chaotic situation here in the U.S. Well, Vardit Ravitsky, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a very interesting and informative conversation. I feel very honored that you took the time to be with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I think this is an important topic that touches on the lives of most families. So thank you so much for the opportunity.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace. I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.